Baim ladies. We're studying today Parashat Ki Tisa. Parashat Ki Tisa is a continuation of the construction of the Mishkan and its vessels and the Kohen Gadol's clothing. We never talked yet about the one that actually was the main one involved in the whole construction, a tzaddik by the name of Besaleel ben Uri ben Hur lematei Yehuda. Besaleel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur from the tribe of Yehuda, says his name, Besaleel, literally means Besaleel. He was in the shadow of God. As if to say he possessed such a divine wisdom that it says if he needed to create the world himself, he would be able to use different names of God and create the world. So he was definitely most capable and most talented in order to construct the Mishkan, not only in its physical sense, but of course in its spiritual sense. But I want to analyze one pasuk. Torah tells us, "Va'amale oto ruach Elohim." God says, "And I have put into Bezalel a spirit of God, bechokmah, betbuna, ubdat, with all sorts of insight and knowledge and wisdom, lachashov mahashavot." He was able to make calculations, laasot bazav bekesuf ubanechoshet, in order to deal with the gold and the silver and the copper. There's a famous story told about the great Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva of Chaim Volozhin. As every Rosh Yeshiva, it fell upon him the burden to collect for the yeshiva's budget. And every year he'd go out and he'd collect. One year he got tired, and he decided that he has to hire an administrator. The administrator came to the rabbi and said, "Chacham, they give you money because they respect you. When you visit the Baal HaBayit, it's an honor for them. They feel compelled. They feel embarrassed. Me, there's no reason why they should give me money. I'm only coming as your messenger. I'm not the rabbi. And my appearance is not from the most hashuv people. I think I need to buy a nice new suit in order to so I'll gain some respect." The rabbi says, "You're right. It's proper that the collector presents himself properly. The rich man respects people that look good. Go buy a new suit." So he bought a fancy suit. He tells the hacham, "I have a new suit, but my shoes are old. What's a new suit worth if my shoes are old? The first thing a rich man looks at is the shoes. Are they polished? Are they black? Are they nice?" So already we bought the main thing. He says, "You're right. You need a pair of shoes. Go buy a good pair of shoes." And then from the shoes, he said, "But a tie. The tie makes the whole suit. Okay, go buy a nice new tie. And where am I going to put all the money? I can't put it in the pocket. It's going to stick out. I need an attaché case, nice leather." So the rabbi says, "Oh, I get that also." And then he tells the rabbi, "How am I going to get there? How am I going to travel? I can't walk. If I walk, by the time I get to the rich man's house, I'll be haggard. I won't be able to concentrate what I'm doing. I need a car." They didn't have cars in those days. They had a coach with horses. So he got him a driver. The rabbi tells him before he goes, "Listen, there's one man. Make sure you go to this man's house. He gives us every year half the budget of the yeshiva. This is the main guy on the list." So he... administrator pulls up in front of the horses, pull up in front of the guy's house. The rich man looks out the window. He doesn't know who this man is. Maybe a tycoon is coming to visit him. He has no idea. He never saw such a fancy horse. And then when he sees a guy get out, he's dapper. He's presentable like this. He doesn't know what it is. Knocks on the door. "Who is it?" "I'm coming from the Volozhin Yeshiva." "Volozhin Yeshiva? What does this man have to do with Volozhin Yeshiva?" He brings him into the house. He's, "I'm collecting. I come from Rav Chaim Volozhin. The rabbi is too tight to collect. I'm the new guy." He says, "You're the new guy?" He says, "I understand very good." He writes him a check. The administrator looks at the check. Nothing. It's not even a. It's not even a pittance. It's worthless. Not even a respectable. He's nervous now. This is the main guy. What's going to be? And he gives him a whole story. You know, business is bad. I don't have money. And he gives him a whole. He comes back to Rav Chaim Volozhin. Rav Chaim sees it. He says, "No, you can't be. Can't be. This man already has so much money. The business is good. Something happened to him. He got turned off. Let me go myself." So Rav Chaim Volozhin goes himself to the rich man's house. The rich man sees him. He runs out of his house to greet him on the walkway. Hacham, Baruch Haba, hugs him, kisses him. We miss you, please. Tvaddal, come in. He sits with the rabbi. He's talking to him. The rabbi said, "I don't understand you. I thought you were upset at me." "Upset at you? Chas v'shalom. What are you talking? Maybe you're upset at the yeshiva?" He says, "Well, I always like to support Volozhin because I was always thinking in my mind, I'm giving money and it's going to pay for yeshiva men learning. It's paying for books. It's paying to feed the yeshiva men. It's paying for the lights. It's paying to promote Torah. Now I see the administrator is wearing a fancy suit. He has horses. He has attaché case. I don't want my money paying for the straw to feed the horses. And I'm not interested to pay for this guy's wardrobe. But see, it's squandering the money. I'm not interested in such a thing. That's why I didn't give my daily, yearly pledge." So Rav Chaim Volozhin says, "You read Gemara?" He says, "No, I don't read Gemara." He says, "You read Mishnah?" He says, "No, I don't read Mishnah." He says, "Chumash do you read?" He says, "Yeah, I read Chumash." He says, "Oh, do me a favor. Explain to you what it says in Parashat Ki Tisa. Parashat Ki Tisa talks about Bezalel. It tells us he was godly. He had divine wisdom. He knew everything. And then in the middle it tells us, Lachshov Mahashavot. He knew how to make calculations." I mean, that's of course. You're talking about a man that knew much more than that. It's like saying, the man is a miraculous man, he's a divine man, and also he knows how to count. He knows how to count. Certainly knows how to count. That's par for the course. What do you mean the Torah is telling us? He knows how to make calculations. So he says, I'll tell you what the explanation of the Pasuk is. When the money was being donated for the construction of the Mishkan, they stood online. Bezalel received the donations. Everybody wanted their money and their gold to go where? In the holiest place. So everybody told Bezalel, "Do me a favor, Bezalel, put this in the Holy of Holies, this piece over here. Just take care of me." The next guy came with his gold. "Do me a favor, Bezalel, put me on the kirubim. Put me." The next guy comes and says, "Do me a favor, Bezalel, handle it for me. You're my friend. I want to be in the Aron, or the Luchota." Each guy wants their money to be in the best spot so they can go out and say, "Look where my money is." How did Bezalel know where exactly to put each guy's donation? So it says in the Pasuk, Lachshov Mahashavot. Not that he was able to make mathematical calculations. He was able to make calculations in what the giver was thinking. Lachshov Mahashavot. When the guy stood in front of him, he looked at him, he said, "This guy's giving the money, he wants kavod. All right, we'll take it. But we'll put it in the outside area. It's not so the Shem Shamayim. He's doing it for prestige." Next guy comes, he's giving it a little better intent, but it's half and half. Half for God and half his ego. All right, we'll take it. We'll put that in the middle area. Another guy's coming, he's giving it for Hashem, only to promote God's name. He wants to give it anonymously. He doesn't want anybody to know about it. So he looked at him. He says, "Wow, this guy's machshava. Very good. This guy's going to go into Kodesh." So Bezalel had a tremendous wisdom knowing exactly where to place the money based on the intent of the giver. Lachshov Mahashavot. He was able to know what the giver was thinking, hence La'asot Bazahav Bekesu Banechoshet. Then he knew what to do with the gold and the silver and the copper. So Rav Chaim turned to the wealthy man and said, "My friend, today we don't have Bezalel, but God is still here. When you gave your money to the yeshiva, God knew your intent. And God knew you gave it l'shem shamayim. God channels the money according to the intent of the giver. Undoubtedly, your money was given to pay for the yeshiva men learning, to pay for the gemariyot, to pay for their lunch. Another fellow that gave with less intent, their money went for bathroom supplies,
their money went. You need a bathroom in the yeshivas. You need to buy toilet paper also. But who wants their money to go for that? It depends on the intent of the giver. Another guy went for the garbage cans. Another guy went for the light bulbs and so on. According to the intent of the giver, God in His wisdom sees to it that the money will be used according to that. Therefore, there's nothing for you to worry about. You're giving Lashem Shamayim for all these years. You're not paying for hay. You're not paying for horse maintenance. You're paying for the yeshiva men. Therefore, there's nothing. When he heard that haidush, he said, "This I never heard before. This is emet." And of course, he wrote the rabbi out a check for the half the amount for the yeshiva's funding. Torah tells us, interesting thought. Bezalel was the grandson of Hur. What was so special about this fellow called Hur? Hur actually was murdered in this week's parasha. Murdered. You remember when the Jewish people were about to do the Egel, the golden calf, which we'll talk about soon. Hur was a rabbi. He was the third man in charge. The hierarchy was Moshe Rabbeinu, Aharon, Hur. Those were the three chiefs. Moshe is gone. Moshe went to the mountain to get to the Torah. So you have Aharon and Hur left. They saw that Moshe is delaying. They said, "Oh, we got to do an Egel." As they do in the Egel, Hur comes and protests. He says, "No, by no means. You're out of your mind. No Egel. Impossible." What did they do to Hur? They killed him. They weren't happy with his protest, with his opinion, so they killed Hur. The rabbis tell us as a result of Hur's self-sacrifice to do the right thing, he had a grandson called Bezalel who came and built the Mishkan. What's the payback over here? Because he's willing to die, he gets a grandson. So I once heard a wonderful explanation. The Jewish people, and this is fundamental. Would any of you in this room ever dream to build a golden calf and say to it, "You are my God"? None of us would dream. God, Chas v'shalom, to build a golden calf. Especially these are the people that just came out of Egypt. They saw the miracles of God. How is it possible that they can come and erect a golden calf? The explanation that Ramban says is, it wasn't as bad as it seemed to be. Their intent wasn't that bad. So what were they doing? Moshe Rabbeinu was gone. The Jewish people came to a conclusion. They said like this: we needed an intermediary between us and God. We were never able to talk directly. Moshe was the go-between. Anytime we had an issue, we told Moshe. Moshe related to God. God told it to Moshe. Moshe told it to us. Who's going to be the go-between? We need to put some type of medium in between us and God. So they thought and they remembered an image that they saw when they left Egypt. When they left Egypt, they saw the throne of God. And on the throne of God, there was an image of an ox. Obviously, the ox has very spiritual meanings if it made it to the throne of God. So therefore, they chose that image in order to represent them, to be the medium. It's like they were building a shul. What is a shul? God is everywhere in the world. But we come to the synagogue, because that's where God is concentrated, and that's where we meet God, that's where we talk to God, that's where we communicate to God. Egel, in their mind, was to replace Moshe, not to replace God. That was the original intent. But what? Hur, after hearing their logic and all that, he knew it's not the right thing. They were trying to tell him, "No, we mean well, it's good." Hur wasn't interested. Moshe is the leader. He's coming back. He didn't accept any deviation, any logic, any reasoning. They were trying to give him reasoning. "No, it's good for this reason and for that reason, and we mean well." Hur closed his mind from all reasoning and all logic. Hur said, "No, you can't do it. It's haram." "But what about this reason, Rabbi? What about the Asur? Haram. Moshe's coming back." until we get express permission from Moshe to build an Egel, we can't do it. So what did they do to Hur? They killed him. Because Hur was not willing to reason with them. And what's the payback for a man that's not willing to reason? He'll get a grandson that was gifted with the greatest ability of reason. He was gifted with the greatest ability of chokhmah. Because Hur did not make calculations. He could have said, we'll do it, it's better than nothing. The people are going to kill me. Is it worth it for me to die? He could have made all sorts of calculations and rationalizations why he should do it. But what did Hur do? He said, there's no calculations, finished. It's haram. If I have to die because of this, I die. God says, you didn't make calculations? You're going to be blessed with a grandson that is going to be a master at making calculations. Measure for measure on Hur's self-sacrifice. But what do we have to say for Aharon? The Pasuk writes that Aharon actually seemingly had a big hand in Egel. They came to Aharon. Aharon said, fine, go to your wives and bring back the jewelry. And we'll make the Egel. Bring back the gold. And that's a very big indictment on Aharon. And it was Aharon's plan. We read the Pesukim simply. You say Aharon was an accomplice here. Aharon was right there. He was the one that gave them the idea. Go bring the gold from your wives and we'll make the Egel. So the Da'at Zekinim Ba'alei Tosafot says, wait. Be very careful before you indict Aharon for any type of wrongdoing over here. Aharon's intent was pure. You see, Aharon knew there was a prophecy that said there's going to come a day in Jewish history where there's going to be a Kohen that is going to get killed. And he knew on that day, if the Kohen gets killed, and a prophet. On the day that a Kohen and the prophet gets killed will be a very, very ominous day for the Jewish people. This happened in the times of the Beit HaMikdash when they killed Zechariah. And that was already the end. His blood boiled and millions of people died. Aharon saw they killed Hud already. That's the Navi. If they kill me today, I'm the Kohen, it means devastation. So the Da'at Zekinim says, he told them, go home, ask your wives for their earrings and their jewelry, and we'll come back and we'll build an Egel. You know what he was doing? It was a stalling tactic. Aaron's figuring which lady is going to be willing to give up her jewelry, her earrings, for what purpose? To build an Egel? I'm not giving you my earrings. It's personal, sentimental. I should give you all my jewelry that I have. Go somewhere else. That was Aaron's plan. It looks like from the Pesukim that he was aiding and abetting. But in truth, he wasn't Azid. He was just trying to stall. Maybe Moshe will come in the interim. He didn't tell them, go home and bring me your own money. He told them, bring me your wife's gold. In order to be some resistance and some delay. But at the end, the money came very quickly. So it backfired. From here, we learned a great lesson. Our rabbis tell us, Hevedan et kol ha'adam lechav zechut, that people must give each other the benefit of the doubt. Especially when it comes to a great rabbi like Aharon, even though the Pesukim sound like he was the main cause, when you analyze his reasoning behind why he asked for it, he was doing it l'shem shamayim. He wasn't doing it in order to speed up the process of building an Egel, he was doing it azit to delay the process. So in effect, Aharon was the good guy in this story. A great lesson of giving somebody benefit of the doubt. Rav Hutner once said, Alav HaShalom, every trait in the world, good or bad, can be used in life for good. For example, jealousy. Jealousy is a rotten trait. It's a terrible trait. And people we speak about all the time, you can't have jealousy. But what? Hutner says you need jealousy sometimes. For example, when you see somebody more religious than you, then jealousy is a good thing. It inspires you. I want to be like that person. Then it's possible to use jealousy. And go through every single trait, being a miser, being cheap. Cheap is not a good trait. But maybe when it comes to spending on materialism above and beyond what we're supposed to, then it's good to be miserly, not to be frugal a little. So you can always use a bad trait, he said, the worst of traits, and channel it for a good thing. So they once asked him, Hakam, one of the bad traits in the world, people have crooked minds. People are warped in their thinking. You talk to a person, he has straight thinking, you can have a conversation with him, he's logical. You tell him something, he understands, he adds the next step, you add back, you conclude. But there are people, and we know people like this, they don't, they always, whatever you tell them, they twist it, they make it crooked, they misunderstand you, they come to different conclusions. They're warped minds. They ask Rabbi Hutner, a warped mind, when is that necessary? You're telling us every trait in the world can be used for good. When in the world are we supposed to use warped minds? So Rabbi Hutner said, when it comes to giving your friend the benefit of the doubt. Because sometimes you see something and it's black and white. You say, what is the guy doing? He's wrong. So sometimes you have to twist your brain and think of the most crazy things and think of some of the most crooked situations in order to give the guy the best. Maybe his reason is this and that, even though it's so far-fetched. And even though there's no odds that that happens, that's when you should be twisted and bent. When it comes to giving your friend the benefit of the doubt. One time there was a fellow walking in Manhattan. He saw a religious man with a beard and a hat. And he was walking down the street and the people in the Manhattan are giving out flyers and all sorts of things. So the religious man took a flyer and then he looked at it and he threw it back in the guy's face. And the other Jew, the modern guy, was walking behind him and said, yeah, these black hat guys, they have no derech eretz. You don't like it, take it, put it back in the garbage, fold it up. What do you have to throw it in the guy's face? What kind of thing is this over here? He says, terrible, they make a bad name for us. All this went through his mind. He says, I'm going to take a paper from the guy. I'm going to do it the right way to make the tikkun for this guy. And sure enough, he takes the paper and he looks at it and it says, Jews for Yeshu. Guy's trying to proselytize people. A guy's trying to make people for Yeshu. So he took it himself and threw it back in the guy's face. What happens? He judged him already. He killed him already. He said he's an Asha. He's no good. He passed a bad judgment. But you have to be very patient. People would do that to Aharon also. Oh, look at Aharon. He went. He did. Who are you talking about? You're talking about Aharon HaKohen over here. If he did it, you must ask why he did it, because he had a reason. In general, that applies to rabbis in general. It applies to people in general. When we see them act and we see them do certain things and we question, why are they doing it? What's their reason? Must be because of this. And we're ready, we write it in stone as if that's it and finished. That's a deen. And then we come maybe later on and realize maybe that wasn't the reason. Sometimes you have to twist yourselves and make your mind crooked in order to give your friend the benefit of the doubt. Torah tells us that after the Jewish people worshipped the Egel, as we explained, the Egel started off as a good thing. It's intermediary, but since it wasn't sanctioned, since Hur told them don't do it, and Aharon had a gun to his head, so he wasn't able to stop it, it led to idolatry. That's the rule. Things that start off on a weak foundation, eventually the building starts to grow and starts to get taller. But if the foundation is off, the building turns into the Leaning Tower of Pisa. The foundation must be straight and solid and perfect in order that the structure is straight. The foundation of Egel, although it looked like good intent, it looked like, L'shem Shamayim, we're going to do it, L'shem, intermediary, we're going to talk to God. But since it wasn't sanctioned by the rabbis, it's off. And therefore it led into idolatry, it led into immorality, and all the biggest averot. God comes along and says, I'm going to destroy the people. Finished. It was such a sin that God couldn't tolerate it. He said, finish, I'll destroy them and start over again. Moshe, you can remain the leader. You're spared. Everybody else dies. Take two.
Moshe Rabbeinu comes along in a most masterful prayer. And he comes along and he tells God the following. Vayhal Moshe. Torah says, Vayhal. It says he prayed so much until he got sick. Vayhal comes from the word chole. He got sick from the praying. He was praying with such a strong fervor. And what did he tell God? He tells God, Lama yichere Hashem ba'amecha. God, why are you getting angry at your people? Asher otzeta me'eretz Mitzrayim, that you took out of Egypt, bechoach gadol u'biyad hazaka, with great strength and power. And all the rabbis are bothered. Moshe, you're making it worse. He comes to God and says, what are you getting angry at your people that you took out of Egypt with strength? And God says, exactly! After all I did, after I took them out, that's exactly why I'm getting angry. Because I took them out of Egypt with great strength and power. Moshe Rabbeinu, don't say anything! You're making it worse. What are you telling God that? You're supposed to make it good. What did he mean when he said, why are you getting angry at your people that you took out of Egypt? So there's a famous story told in order to explain this. There was a man. He was an Alman. His wife had passed away. And he was looking to get remarried. And he's looking from girl to girl to girl. And he doesn't find what he likes. Finally they told him, why don't you call the Shadchan? Shadchan, maybe she knows girls in the same situation that would be compatible. I never called the Shadchan before. Call it, it's worth it. He calls the Shadchan. He was a wealthy man. He calls the Shadchan. The Shadchan hears his whole story. And says, I think there's a girl that you might like. He says, but I don't go on blind dates. I have to see her first. Before I ask her out. He says, fine. She works in this restaurant over here. She owns the restaurant. Go to the restaurant like a customer. And you look at her. You'll see what she's doing. And then we'll make the date. He says, fine. He goes to the restaurant. Makes believe he's reading the menu. Meanwhile, he's looking at her. He's analyzing how she's talking, how she's walking, how she's this and that. He says, she's very good girl. She's pretty. She's nice. Suffer everything. Calls a shadchan. Okay, make the date. They make the date, they go out. He loves her. He wants to get married. But she tells him, listen, I'm willing to get married also, but I owe $7,000 in debts on the restaurant. Give me 6 months to pay the debt on the restaurant, and then we'll get married. So, okay, fine. The Shadchan calls him up and says, what are you talking about? You're going to wait 6 months for this girl? You love her. Get married to her immediately. But she says she has debts. You're a rich man. Pay the debt. Finish. Chasna. What are you going to... You're worried about it? For this $6,000, $7,000, you're making an issue? And he says, you're right. What am I thinking? Yeah, I'll pay the debt. You're right. I want to get married to her immediately. Now, it's a few days before the wedding now. So he says, come, I'm going to take you shopping. She doesn't have any clothes. She's on here. He takes her to a fancy department store. They're going shopping. And she takes off her old clothes and she puts on her new clothes, all the clothes that he bought. The rich man, he takes her old clothes and puts it in his suitcase. The lady tells her, what are you doing with my clothes? He said, what's the difference to you? I bought you new clothes. What's the difference? What I want to do with these clothes? She said, I can't say anything. He bought me these new clothes. Keep them. Now, they go to the day of the wedding and he's rushing. He wants to get married. She says, let's go for lunch first. Then we'll go to the Beit Din, we'll get married. They're making a small thing in the Beit Din anyway. He says, no, I want to go now. We didn't eat lunch yet. Let's go to the restaurant. I'll make some pancakes. And then we'll go to... So, okay, he's rushing, he's nervous. So she's making the pancake. He's looking at his watch. He's looking. Finally, can't wait anymore. I don't want to eat. I want to get married now. So, okay, she doesn't want to get into a machloka with him. We'll go now. She takes the pancakes that are in the batter, they're still half-baked, she puts them in her pocketbook. He says to her, what are you, crazy? What are you doing with the pancakes? She says, what's the difference to you? It's my pig, I can take whatever I want. She says, yeah, you're right, she's allowed to. They run to the bathing, they get married, immediately it's finished. Baruch Hashem, they got married, they're happy. A few weeks later, they get into their first machloka, they get into their first fight. Back and forth, words were exchanged. All of a sudden, the man goes to his suitcase and he takes out her old dress. Says, do you remember what you were? You were a nothing. You had, look at the clothes you used to wear. Before I married you, you had zero. I made you, I did. started to make strong mahloket. So she went to her pocketbook and she took out the pancake. She said, who ran after who? I ran after you. You couldn't even wait 2 minutes till the pancake was made and you ran after me. When he saw the pancake, he remembered the love that he had. He says, the truth is, look how much I loved her. I couldn't wait 30 seconds. And he forgot about it. So this is the same story. This is the same story. This is the same story that is told. Borei Olam told Avraham Avinu that the Jewish people are going to be in Egypt for 400 years. But God couldn't wait. Instead of 400 years, God took us out 190 years earlier. We only stayed in Egypt after 210 years. So Moshe Rabbeinu was telling God, God, Zechor, remember your people. Remember what you did, that you took your Jewish people out of Egypt. Who ran after who? We were still supposed to be in Egypt now for 400 years. You ran after us. You pursued us. Remember the love that you had for us. We shouldn't have been doing Egel. We were supposed to be in Egypt. You couldn't wait to take us out. Therefore, Borei Olam, remember not that you took us out of Egypt. Remember how early you took us out. Remember you didn't have patience. You couldn't wait. Moshe Rabbeinu was telling God, remember the love that you had for us, that you couldn't even wait to the end of the sentence. When God heard that, he remembered the love that he had, that he took us out early. He told Moshe Rabbeinu, Salachti kedvarecha, I forgive them. But the Gemara says that the Egel was paid for and is still being paid for throughout every generation. Every generation that has its catastrophe, the Gemara says there's a certain element in it of the punishment of Egel. For example, God forbid we talk about the Holocaust. We don't know reasons for the Holocaust, but it's certain to say there was an element of Egel in the Holocaust. Just as there was in every pogrom and in every persecution of the Jewish people, there's always an element of Egel. So one rabbi gave a good example to this. There was once a king. The king came along and made a proclamation. He got angry at his son. He said, I'm taking this big boulder over here and I'm going to throw it on my child. Finish, I'm going to decimate him. He's angry and wanted to kill him. And the king had a policy, once he makes a proclamation, there's no hatara, there's no way he can get out of it, he must follow through. And sure enough, the next day, he regrets, I'm going to kill my son, but I can't get out of it. So he called one of his smart advisors, and the advisor says, I have a way out. We'll take a hammer, we'll chisel the stone into little pebbles, and you'll take the pebbles and you'll throw them at your son. Eventually, the whole stone will go on your son, but at least you won't kill him. That's exactly what Borei Olam did. He made a thing, I'm going to kill the Jewish people. I'm going to destroy them. He couldn't take back his word. So Borei Olam says, instead of killing them in one shot, I'll kill them throughout the generation, slowly, slowly, instead of giving them a full punishment. Like the Pasuk says, that the sin will be throughout the course of history. Moshe Rabbeinu came along and said to God, as we discussed last week, God, im ayin mecheni na misifrecha asher katavta. Moshe Rabbeinu says, God, it's my fault. He blames the whole thing on himself. The rabbis all ask, what's Moshe Rabbeinu blaming it on himself for? It's not Moshe Rabbeinu's fault. So they give an example. They come along and say, there was a king. He had a loyal friend. And the king also had a son that was a wayward son. The son would always get into trouble. The king would vow to punish him. And then the king's best friend would come along and say, you can't do it. It's your son. Hazit, have mercy. Always the friend would stick up for the kid. And the king would listen to his friend. Finally, one day, the son did something intolerable. The king said, that's it. It's over. I'm putting him in prison. So the king's friend came along and said, my dear king, I'm resigning today. Why are you resigning for? He says, because it's my fault that this happened with your son. Your fault? What did you do? He said, you don't understand. The only reason why your son is so bad, because he knew that I'm going to always come and get him out of trouble. So I have a hand in this over here. So I'm going to resign. So the king says, no, it's not your fault. Don't resign. He says, fine, but forgive your son. He said, okay, I'll forgive him. The same thing in Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu says, my fault. The Jewish people are spoiled. They know that I'm there, that I'm going to handle it for them. So therefore they had the leisure to make avonot, and they know I'm going to come and pray. Therefore, God, it's my fault, I resign. Mehenina misufreka, erase me from your book. What does God tell Moshe? You can't resign. What does Moshe tell God? I can't resign? Then forgive them. Borei Olam says, okay, I'll forgive them. In the zechut of Moshe, taking the blame for the Jewish people, Borei Olam was kivyachol forced in order to forgive them. That's the story of the Egel. The end of the parasha, the Torah tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu reached a very high level. His face started to shine. He actually had to start wearing a mask. He had to start wearing a covering over his face because his face emanated a glow as sharp as the sun. As the Gemara says, Pene Moshe kipne hama. The face of Moshe was like the face of the sun. And at that point, Moshe Rabbeinu asks God a question. He tells God, Hodi'enina, or Har'enina et kevodecha, Hodi'enina et derachecha. He asks God, please, show me your ways. Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to understand God's infinite wisdom. He was asking him the million-dollar question, the question that we never really get an answer to, but Moshe felt he was on the level of comprehending it. He asked God, why do righteous people suffer and why do wicked people prosper? God, all my life, I finally reached a level over here, my face is glowing, I'm close to you, I spent 40 days and 40 nights with the angels in heaven, now I'm on the level to know why Sadiq ve'ra'lo, Rasha ve'tovlo. Does God answer him? Well, the answer that the Torah writes is, Borei Olam says, Vayomer lo tuchal lirot et panai. God says, no, you can't see me, you can't see my face. Ki lo yirani ha'adam v'chai, nobody can understand me and live. Vayomer Hashem ine makom iti, but there's a place here with me, v'nitzavta al asur, by the rock. והיה בעבור כבודי ושמתיך בנקלת אסור וסקותי כפי עליך ועשירותי את כפי I'll remove my hands וראית את אחוריי. You'll see my back. It's very cryptic what God was answering. Come, stand on the rock. Stand on the rock next to me from here. But you can't see my face. You can only see my back. What is God answering? What kind of answer is that? The answer is more perplexing than the question. The Hatam Sofer explains that God was telling Moshe, if you want to understand my ways, the only way you're going to understand it is you have to come and look at it from where I'm standing, God says. From your perspective, Moshe, there's no way to understand God's ways. You're on earth. You're too close to the situations. But there's a stone over here. Get on the stone, as if rise up and look at it. When you come up to Shamayim and you look at it from an aerial view, when you look at it from God's vantage point, there's no questions. Everything makes sense. But from where you're standing, you can't understand it. But Moshe was asking, I want to understand it from here. I don't want to wait. So God says, fine. You can't understand me looking at me forward. You can only understand me from the back, which means God was saying, you can only understand me in hindsight. You can only understand me in retrospect. In life, it's hard to figure out things as they're happening. As a person is going through the different occurrences in life, it's difficult to make sense of them. But when you look 20 years back, and you say, why? Oh, now it makes sense to me. That's why Hashem did it. Because of that event, it led to this event, to that event. That's how I met my husband, and that's how we had children, and that's how we found our house. And that. But at the time that it's happening, when you're looking at God head on,
לא תוכל לראות את פניי.
You cannot look at me forward. You can only look at me, meaning understand me from my back. Which means when you look at God's actions in hindsight, like we explained last week in Megillat Esther, then things become sensible, then things become understandable. But to try to understand it as they're happening, this becomes difficult. There's a famous story told of one of the rabbis, the Ramban, that had some very, very perplexing questions. And one of his students, before he died, the Ramban came to him and said, "Listen, I want you to go up, take this page of questions with you, and take this name of God, and this name of God will give you entry to the highest levels in heaven. Just show them the name, they'll open up all the doors for you. When you get there, ask them all these questions, and please communicate them back to me in the dream." The student went, he died, he had the name, and sure enough, he shows the doorman the name, they open up doors for him, next level, he's showing the shim, he has the paper of the Ramban with him, with major, major perplexing dilemmas that the Ramban had in his life. And he finally gets to the highest level, and he communicates to the Ramban back, and he says, "Rabbi, it worked like a charm. They let me in wherever I went." He says, "Well, what about my questions?" He says, "You'll forgive me, Rabbi, but the place where you sent me, there are no questions. There's no questions. Your questions are not questions. An answer is deserved if there's a question. But where I am, there's so much clarity. It's so clear. The questions dissipated. There's no she'ela that deserves a teshuvah. From God's vantage, where God is, there are no questions. Everything is clear. Everything is emet." That's what Borei Olam was telling Moshe. Hinei makom iti. You really want to understand it good? You have to be with me. But if you want to try to figure it out on earth, v'ra'itat achorai. You can only see me from the behind, from retrospect, from hindsight. Ufanai lo yira'u. This was the question that Moshe asked and God's answer. One rabbi gave an example, and we'll conclude with this. A fellow once went to visit NASA, the space center in Houston. And he wasn't a smart fellow. And they're bringing him into all the different rooms. The first room is where all the mechanisms of running the space shuttle are. All the screens and all the computers and all the toggles and the switches and the communications. Thousands of buttons, like the buttons in the cockpit of a plane, but big, and there's hundreds of people working, and he's looking at all the buttons, and he's looking at all the analysts, and he's amazed. They take him into another room. There he sees all the components to build a space shuttle. Big pieces of metal and screws and bolts and all sorts of pieces of scrap metal. And he's quiet the whole time. After 2 hours of taking the tour, they take him to a room where he sees on the floor some more components of the shuttle. There's a little bolt this big. So he turns to the guy giving him the tour. "Excuse me, can I ask you one question?" He says, "Certainly." He says, "What do they use that bolt for?" So the guy tells him, "You tipish. Everything else till now you understood. Until we got to this bolt over here, now you have a question. You saw a million things now. But the problem that you have is, what's this item over here? You didn't understand anything. So what are you, did this also add it to the list of the things you don't understand? What are you even asking?" When people come along and question God's ways, why did God do this? Well, everything else God does in the world, you have answers to. It's this, as if this is the only thing we don't understand. We don't understand anything. Do we understand how the sun rises? Do we understand how the body is able to keep a constant temperature of 98.6 Even though you go in the winter and it's 20 degrees out, there's no thermostat, there's no heat, there's no Con Edison, there's no Brooklyn Union gas, no nothing. But how is it possible to keep 98.6 on the dot constant? Here we have the biggest systems. We spend thousands of dollars and we cannot keep air control. We always have problems with our air conditions break every year. And here the body is able to do it without thinking, without noise, without any agitation. That's you understand? You understand 98 point? Do you understand how long would it take? How long would it take to take a potato that's raw and soften it? You'd have to stick it in boiling hot water for I don't know how long. 10 minutes, 15 minutes. How long does it take to boil a potato to make it soft? Must take 10 or 15 minutes. Maybe more, maybe a half hour. But imagine. Imagine if somebody swallowed a piece of raw potato, it goes in the stomach, and the stomach somehow is able to grind this raw potato with boiling hot water for a half hour. The stomach is able to do that same process to the potato and bring it into the blood system. Do you know what type of a machine the stomach is over here? It's more powerful than boiling, scalding hot water. It's more powerful than a grinder, than a machine. And it does it without you feeling it, without knowing it. The miracle of the stomach is, if it's able to chew up and churn everything, how come it doesn't chew up itself? It itself is a piece of meat. How come it doesn't dissolve itself? Miracle of miracles. We never thought about that. Our only question is, why did God do this? Everything else, you know. You don't understand anything. You understand how the water can get from the bottom of the tree to the top leaf. How does there's no elevator in the tree trunk? It defies gravity. How is it possible to go from the ground all the way up? You never saw water go up, but all the trees are fine. They're all green. The top leaf is green also. So we don't understand anything in life. So to come along and ask in an arrogance, God, just explain me this. That implies that everything else we know in truth, our question should be, God, we don't know anything. Your ways are beyond us. And in truth, it's a blessing. One rabbi said, I am proud to have a God that I don't understand. Because that means God is smarter than me. I wouldn't want to have a God that I can predict. Because if my God makes sense, so then everybody could be God. If God's moves are predictable and rational, so what makes God different than the intellect of human beings? You want a God that's deep. You want a God that sometimes you say, what is he doing? That shows he's on a different level. Be'ezat Hashem will be zocheh to that day. Well, we won't be able to see only hindsight, but we'll see the face of God.